You come to religion through fear, love, knowledge. I came through fear, evolved to learn and gained knowledge. And ultimately, I just love God and love the community. I love how this religion changed my life. I had to make it my own.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. This week on In Good Faith, we have a really beautiful story of someone who grew up sort of knowing about faith around the edges. She's from an immigrant family. She didn't even really learn about her parents' faith because they had no place to worship and practice it, at least for years. And then her life's journey takes her to a place where she absolutely needed God and found God. I'm in studio today with two of our student producers, Leah King.
Hi, Steve.
Also, Aaliyah Ebert.
Hey, everyone.
And what struck you about Mary LaHodge?
The most impactful moment of this interview for me was when she described her kind of low point that led to her turning to God.
You know, you carry a story and a legacy with you as an immigrant because your parents have stories of a different place, but you've never been there. And she starts off, or somebody asks her, well, what do you know about the mosque? And she says, nothing. And here she is, the daughter of Muslim immigrants who are trying to build a mosque. Mary works as a professional freelance writer for a prominent law firm in Boston, and over the years, she's reimagined religion not as an organized institution, but as an open question. Bird on a Wire is the name of her book that we're talking about, and she makes a compelling case to her readers to do the same.
Well, it was a 30-year struggle for my grandparents. See, my grandparents were the first immigrant generation. They came from Lebanon. Then my parents were born here. This idea of building a mosque when there was none had to be done by both generations, my grandparents and my parents, who eventually married, grew up, and had families of their own. And it took them so long to raise money. And really, it was the Christians and Jews who were their neighbors who contributed to funding this building. It was built in 1964. I was just getting ready to leave for college. And my mother said, no, you could go to the mosque now. I didn't grow up with a mosque. I didn't even know the name of this religion. I had no idea what a mosque was for. So I said, are my friends going to be there? They were all Christians and Jews. I mean, I lived in Weymouth, Massachusetts, which is south of Boston. And she said, no, your friends are not going to be there. And I said, well, then I'm not going. So what did I think of it? I thought nothing of it. And I left for the next 20 years. I came back in 1984. And I knew I was related to almost all of the families that were founding the mosque. There were 8 Muslim families in Quincy, Massachusetts, in a neighborhood. And that's where they met. That's where they built the mosque. And my aunt was the secretary in the office. And when I returned after 20 years, she said, I think I'll retire and you can have my job, which was so typical of my favorite aunt. So I started working at the mosque. I still had no idea what this religion was about. And there were about 800 families there.
Wow.
From at least 25 or 26 different countries. And I had no idea who these people were or what their values were or anything. But I learned from them. They actually embraced me because of my family, not because they knew me. But they would come into the office and say, thank God you built this mosque. We're so happy. And I'd be like, okay. just because my grandfather, Muhammad Omar, was the imam. He was the first imam from 1964 till 1982.
Well, you had, I would call it, ringside seat to religious life and faith life for all of those different families and the happenings. And what was it, though, that caused you to actually embrace Islam at some point?
I am a wounded healer, if you know what that is.
Yeah, I think it was Henry Nouwen's expression.
And I was called to write about my experience and bearing witness and my universal love of God. There came a point when life was so difficult for me during those 20 years that I had turned to God after not thinking about God for 20 years or more. And I needed to talk to someone about this big turning point in my life. And I did talk to my grandfather. And can I read from my book this one page?
Please do.
I was pregnant and not married. And I wanted to ask him about what I should do. So I didn't say it was me because I didn't want to disappoint him. I said it was my friend, but he immediately knew what I was talking about. Now, my grandfather, Jiddu, we call him in Arabic, he never, ever judged anyone. So I wasn't afraid. I just didn't want to disappoint him. And we sat in the parking lot of the building where he lived. And he turned to me and he said something I will never forget. Shaking his head and scrunching his face, he asked, "What kind of life, Mary? What kind of life?" Now, he had limited English, but I knew what he meant. What kind of life had I been living that led me here to this moment? So when I returned home, I went right to my bedroom. I was living with my mother. I was 34 years old, and I did not tell her my condition. I rushed upstairs to my bedroom. I had a bad case of self-doubt and no one really to turn to for further advice. So I sat on the floor and looked up at the high ceiling, desperate to connect to the higher power. I remembered two verses of the prayer Jiddu had taught me a long time ago when I was a child. It goes, "You do we worship, and you do we ask for help." "Oh my God," I whispered, "would you hear me if I asked for your help?" I reflected on how I lived my life, self-centered, irresponsible. I wanted to change, but even if I could change, who would I be? Can I be better? I wondered. My neck was getting stiff from staring up at the ceiling. See, I didn't know how to pray. I sobbed and sniffled, and I adjusted my legs on the floor, and I just cried while I was asking, was I asking for the impossible? And who would listen to such a request? Maybe there was no God, or maybe my life was an irredeemable mistake, and I was complete and utter an irredeemable mistake. Maybe God would slam the door in my face or ask me for a pound of flesh to pay for my lifetime of mistakes. Well, I cried out from the depths of my soul, "Please hear me. I want to do an impossible thing, but I can't, not without your help." And that was the last prayer I could think of. There were no more words or tears, and I passed my hand over my face to wipe the tears. Remarkably, nothing had changed. But after a while, I felt better. I cannot say how or why or what, but I felt that something deep within me has shifted. It was not based on reason or logic, but of a feeling of reassurance that overcame me when I stood up in the middle of the room and stretched my legs, I had the strangest idea. I thought I could barter with God. And I whispered to no one in particular, I'm going to have this baby, and you are going to help me.
But you somehow felt that things were all right then, it sounds like.
Yes, I was able to make an important decision. And my book really was written in retrospect. And it showed how God always showed up after I turned to God. He showed up in the one person, or this person, or that person. But this God consciousness that I was alerted to, it has a name in Arabic called taqwa. And in the Bible, it's the same. It's the ability to be consciously aware of a higher power in your life.
That feels almost like a spiritual gift, to be able to learn to recognize that and to feel that as it happens. Did you know from that time that God was with you, whatever path you took, or did you feel guided, or at least that there was an awareness that God had about you?
Well, as I said, in retrospect, I experienced it every step of the way. I'm not someone who has a five-year plan for my life, or not even a one-year plan. I just watched and waited and prayed for help, and God showed up. All I did was turn to God. That was all I did. Rethinking religion or faith in my life did start then, but it was a long journey, and eventually I developed a practice and a theology, and I recognized how my faith evolved over time.
So I think it's interesting that you went to what was then the Hartford Seminary. What motivated you to choose an institution of learning like that rather than a completely secular college?
Well, I was at the mosque in the secretary's office, and the brochure from the Hartford Seminary landed on my desk. And I was part of a community where there was no way for me to learn about this religion. I couldn't sit with the kindergarten kids to learn. I didn't know anything. But the Hartford Seminary had this master's degree program in Christian-Muslim relations. They had 12 courses on everything you could ever want to know. And when I went there in my first class with Dr. Willem Bielefeld, a Protestant, he said, faith in its ultimate extension is not the affirmation of truth. Faith is a lifetime of gratitude.
Interesting.
And that resonated with me, because everything that happened to me once I reached out to God was beautiful. My son's father was the best father that ever lived. He was just a beautiful person who knew how to love and how to discipline and how to teach. And I guess getting the job at the mosque and then finding the brochure on my desk were just these things that kept showing up.
So you go on to become a chaplain on a hospital staff. So you've grown up with Christian and Jewish friends. You're meeting all of these Muslim families at the mosque where you're working. So it seems like you feel a sense of mission about uniting people of faith in spite of denominational differences.
That's right. I wanted to persuade everyone to join an interfaith group and to actually launch an interfaith movement in this country. Why? So that we can recognize and share the things that we have in common. I viewed a lot of the ideas of organized religion today as being very divisive, not unifying. And my universal love of God, I know I share that with people. I know I do. And why not get together and learn from each other. It's affirming of your own faith when you meet someone of another faith. And it's important to know another person's faith. It says that right in the Quran. We made you into different nations and tribes, not to despise each other, but to get to know each other.
Yeah. So I wonder if you have an experience or two where you were able as a chaplain to help or minister to people of other faiths.
Oh, we were trained as multi-faith chaplains. So we were assigned floors and sections of the hospital. This was a big, big acute care hospital in Boston. I was the first Muslim chaplain, and I wasn't able to study that at the seminary, even though later years they did come up with a whole program for teaching Islamic chaplaincy. But I was out there and I was sort of making it up as I went along. But I did have this wonderful experience. I was in the hospital for a brief time, and my friend, a Methodist minister, he came to see me. And I said, I am not thinking about God. All I can think about is that I had major surgery and I'm never going to recover. And I just don't know. I'm just horrible. I'm just a mess. And he said, you know, maybe you need to think of new ways to connect with God. And that is what happened when I was a chaplain. Every situation that I went to, which was usually critical and heartbreaking oftentimes, every situation, I had to learn how to reconnect with God right there, because it would be appropriate for the situation. And that was my favorite part, really, was being able to evaluate the situation and then find a way to connect with God. And even if it was just giving someone a Kleenex or water.
You're still serving then.
It was quite an adventure. It was a spiritual adventure.
So now, after those years of not knowing what that faith was, even though your family grew up in it, do you feel connected to the greater Muslim community?
There are so many mosques now and so many communities. And I have been around a long time. I am a member of several of the mosques, Islamic centers. But for more than 10 years, the Islamic center in Quincy that my family helped found was the only mosque. Mm. And all of the people who came, they eventually learned how to do it, and then they went back to their neighborhoods in other parts of Massachusetts. I mean, this was the only mosque in New England, which is a six-state region, six states. So people came from Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and they eventually went back and built their own mosque. So I've been a member of the community for at least 40 years now. I taught religion at one of the mosques where I still am a member. And the idea that you could just go to any mosque on any corner, I don't know how many mosques there are now in this country, probably close to 2,000, if not more, people just seem to take it for granted. So I felt like I needed to tell the history of the mosque for the sake of this community so that they would have a greater appreciation for what it's like to grow up without a mosque, without a school, without a religion, and they do appreciate it.
You're listening to In Good Faith. We'll be back with more in just a moment. I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. We have another podcast in our BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Appleseed. It's a way to take a journey anytime you would like with stories. Nationally known storytellers telling everything from folktales and fairy tales, personal stories and family tales. It's a great way to get everybody laughing or thinking about some particular topic, and it almost always leads to conversations in the family. If you hit pause after a story and say, what did you think about that? And boy, what does that remind you of? That is a fun time to get to share each other's stories, and that's what The Appleseed does. Check out the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This is In Good Faith. I'm speaking with Mary Lahage about her personal experience in turning to God.
Where does that phrase, bird on a wire, come from?
It came from my grandfather, and to him from his mother, which he told me when I interviewed him. And we would be driving in the car, and he would point to the telephone line and where birds would be lined up on the telephone line. And he would say, "See that? They're lining up for prayer," which is the way Muslims pray. They line up. And he believed that everything worships God.
Well, your grandparents were not just believers, but they worked at it.
When I was the secretary and people would come to me and they would say, "Oh, thank you. We're so happy to have a mosque." I started to see my grandparents' accomplishments through their eyes. And I saw that I had a legacy. And that is what drew me into the religion itself, wanting to learn more. You come to religion through fear, love, knowledge. I came through fear, evolved to learn and gained knowledge. And ultimately, I just love God. And I love the community. I love how this religion changed my life. I had to make it my own.
Uh-huh.
At first, it was part of my journey to find my identity, my ethnic and religious identity. And I embraced it. I was very zealous. But after a while, I saw that culture kind of takes over. And my practice developed by, it's informed by Islam. It's informed by other practices in Christianity, in Buddhism, in Judaism.
Have you had the chance to or felt motivated to do the Hajj?
Yes, I did do the Hajj. The Hajj is no picnic, I'll tell you right now. It's very physically challenging. I went with a group from Boston of 25 men and women. We were approaching Mount Arafat, and before every ritual, our guide and our imam would gather us together and explain what we were going to do the next day, why we were going to do it. So he was explaining what we were supposed to do for this big, important ritual, spend from sunrise to sunset at Mount Arafat, and ask for forgiveness for all your sins. While we were sitting there the night before, I raised my hand and I said, "Excuse me, Imam, I don't believe that God is going to forgive me for my sins. I'm not able to comprehend that." And he said, "That's why we are all here in Mecca, to ask God's forgiveness. If your child did something wrong, would you not forgive him?" And I'm like, "No, okay, yeah, I can get that." But I still wasn't convinced till he said this. He said, "Mary, the only reason that you think God won't forgive you is because you know what you did. You can't forgive yourself, but you're not God." It was an important lesson of the importance of forgiveness, of the importance of forgiving yourself. And if you believe in God, you will forgive yourself.
You've been on this lifelong journey, a spiritual journey, and learning along the way, and then being able to bless others along the way, which I think is beautiful. What do you know now about God that you didn't know back then? What have you learned?
I have a universal love of God. I think that people need to humanize their religion and their faith. I have lived into my faith. One of my sisters in Islam said to me, "If God asked you to do something, would you say no?" That's it. I can never say no to Allah. And Allah means the one worthy of worship. And I feel I am never alone. I feel connected with Allah, and a lot of people do complain about loneliness. I can say, to answer your question, I am never alone.
I was so grateful to talk to Mary Lahage and to see this journey, because it really was a faith journey from, what is a mosque? I don't even know what you do there. And then she gets a job working in one, and that's when she starts to figure it out. And then finally, when she finds herself pregnant, unmarried, she reaches out to God. I love how she sort of ends her prayer with, I'm going to have this baby, and you're going to help me. Whatever conversation we need to have, God can handle it.
Right, and I think that line that she says at the end of her prayer is a total shift in her understanding of God. She's saying, like, do you even hear me? Can you hear me? Are you listening? And then at the end, she's like, you're going to help me. And even though it's kind of a command, I feel like, to me, it seemed like her spirit was softened. And she's like, okay, God is there and he can help me.
Yeah, she had some confidence that that would happen.
Something else that she said in that kind of pivotal moment was, I want to do an impossible thing, but I can't, not without your help.
Yeah.
And I think that's a pretty relatable to the human experience. I think all of us eventually hit a point where we want to do something and we feel like it's impossible, but that's when we can turn to God.
She talks about the legacy that she has because her parents and grandparents built this mosque. So whatever your personal faith is, imagine if you had no place to hold community or to go worship. And what a big deal that was. That's really cool that it took people of faith to just really dig in to even create a place so people could learn about and carry on the tradition of their faith. Many thanks to Mary Lahage for speaking with us. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Ilya Ebert, Leah King, Katarina Martinich, James Sturdivant, and Josh Orton. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Lauren Sandberg, and Ashton Parkinson. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. We'd love it if you would leave a comment or a review wherever you get your podcasts and listen to us. That's Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever. That helps spread the word. Find us on Twitter at InGoodFaithPod, Instagram and Facebook, InGoodFaithPodcast. Our YouTube page is youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith.